It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, a guest makes the case for the creation of a citizen cabinet to give members of Congress more connection with the people they represent.
First, protests broke out around the world after Donald Trump signed an immigration executive order on Friday. The order bars citizens and refugees from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States. That includes Syrians escaping a civil war that has left 11 million people homeless.
President Trump said the order was part of his extreme vetting plan aimed at keeping out terrorists. He also established a priority for religious minorities in evaluating refugees from Muslim countries, which would give Christians preference in the countries involved. The order has gotten criticism from world leaders, including the UN human rights chief, who called the ban mean-spirited and illegal under human rights law.
Over the weekend, airports saw stranded travelers and major protests. Here's a clip of a protest at JFK International Airport in New York. Saeed Khan joins us now. He's a lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. Saeed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back, Veronica.
What reasons did President Trump give and the Trump administration in general give for this executive order on immigration over the weekend?
Well, I mean, the overarching one and defense for his actions is to keep America safe and to protect it, which, of course, is certainly a noble virtue and one with which no one is going to disagree. Unfortunately, that suggests a couple of things. One, as though there was no vetting process already in place prior to his inauguration. And the other is whether or not this is really going to be directed at keeping America safe, given the fact that there really is no alignment between the countries that are targeted and any kind of terrorist attacks that happened on American shores. So those countries which would then be the more plausible target for having sent people to the country, to the United States, countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, 15 out of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were from there, the United Arab Emirates and Egypt, are not part of the focus of this executive order.
Those countries not on the list, what can you tell us about the countries that are on the list?
Well, these are seven countries. There's Iran, there's Iraq, there is Sudan, Somalia, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. Clearly, these are countries where there is an awful lot of turmoil underway. But these are also countries from where we find that because of the turmoil that is occurring, there is the greatest urgency of populations that are moving. I mean, in the case of Syria, the dislocation both internally as well as those fleeing the country is at an order of magnitude that is really unprecedented. At least 35% to 40% of Syrians are either out of the country or have been internally displaced. So that sense of exigent circumstances really warrants then what has been historically and traditionally the American role for taking people in. And again, we find that there has been a very, very stringent vetting process under the prior administration with President Obama. So this notion of trying to be even more stringent in this capacity doesn't really pass muster.
As we heard the sounds of protests this weekend across the country, and this weekend, President Trump's chief of staff, Wisconsinite Reince Priebus, spoke to Chuck Todd on Meet the Press about this. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
More have come from Saudi Arabia to kill Americans than the seven countries combined. Why was Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan and Egypt not included on this list if you are so concerned about this issue?
We are concerned about the issue, Chuck, and that's why we put the seven countries initially into the executive order that were identified previously by Congress, by both the House and the Senate, and the Obama administration as being the seven most watched countries in regard to harboring terrorists. But you bring up a good point. Perhaps other countries needed to be added to an executive order going forward.
So other countries possibly added to the executive order going forward, some countries named there, Saudi Arabia among them. Do you think this is a possibility, more countries on a growing list potentially?
There is that possibility, Veronica, because after all, we need to remember that while he was campaigning, then-candidate Trump was calling for a total Muslim ban. So whether or not this is a testing the waters for something more comprehensive remains to be seen. But on the issue of Saudi Arabia, it's interesting that Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, are not on the current list. I wouldn't really hold one's breath to see them making the list. And part of that has to do with substantial and significant commercial interests that the president has in both of those countries.
Now, you mentioned a Muslim ban, and this is something that Donald Trump, a phrase he had used on the campaign trail, he seems to be moving back from that now, saying that, that's not what we should be calling this. What do you think about how it functions and what's fair to call it?
Irrespective of what he calls it, the practical effect of this executive order and the fact that it's targeting seven Muslim-majority countries is inescapable. This is having a disproportionate impact on Muslims and on people with Muslim names. And we're finding that the ripple effect of this is actually going beyond these people from these seven countries. There are reports coming in that other Muslims, even U.S. citizens, with Muslim names are being subjected to increased and intensive scrutiny while coming back from international trips since Friday. It seems as though there may be this de jure or this by law limitation to just seven countries, but the practical impact of this is much more widespread.
We're talking right now with Saeed Khan, lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University, looking at President Trump's executive order on immigration, an immigration ban that primarily affects Muslim immigrants and refugees. And the Trump administration have said this is similar, they see it, to President Obama, what he did in 2011 when he banned visas for refugees from Iraq for 6 months. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, it's a very poor comparison in several aspects, Veronica. First of all, refugees do not come on visas. That is a fallacy right there. And again, something that apparently either the president does not understand or is particularly and purposely obfuscating. What did happen, though, was that there was a congressional act which looked at a special immigration category for Iraqi refugees. And there was a temporary freeze because the situation at the time warranted it, because there was an increase in terrorist attacks. That hasn't been the case so far. Now, regarding the seven countries as a whole, which the current administration keeps referring to, yes, President Obama did name those seven countries, but it was a very, very limited scope in how the application of immigration laws applied to them. In those cases, it simply applied to those who were dual nationals who had visited one of those countries within the last 6 months, intensifying the level of scrutiny and vetting which would then go toward those individuals. But it was clearly not a categorical ban, whether temporary or permanent.
And Saeed, it's only been a couple of days, but how has this been affecting people both in the United States and around the world who are in the process of traveling or resettling or reuniting with families?
There are cases, Veronica, where, for example, United States citizens have been traveling with family members, either spouses or children, who do not have U.S. citizenship. They might either have a lawful permanent residence or green card, or some are on a fiancé visa, or some are traveling on some other non-immigrant visa, and they're having to make a rather bitter choice. The U.S. citizen is allowed to either travel alone to the United States, leaving behind the family member, or is being told you don't have to come to the United States. You can stay with your family member who is now excluded from traveling to the U.S. So this is having an impact on splitting up families, and it's also having an impact on employees. Some individuals who were outside the country for work-related activity are now finding themselves stranded overseas, and this is now causing major companies like Google and others to issue travel warnings, and in fact is stifling international commerce and business because companies are now reluctant to send employees over even a simple border like Canada in order to conduct business.
We're talking right now with Saeed Khan from Wayne State University, and we're looking at President Trump's immigration ban that primarily affects Muslim immigrants and refugees.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Trump's immigration executive orders? Do you think they make the country safer? Why or why not? Will you or your family or friends be directly affected by this? Do you know anyone who's having trouble going in or out of the country? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a little bit coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our conversation with Saeed Khan, lecturer in Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University. We're looking at President Trump's executive order that bars refugees and immigrants from seven Muslim-majority nations.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think of the president's immigration executive order. What do you make of the list of seven Muslim-majority countries? And what do you think of a potential, in effect, religious test on who can come into the country? Do you support this? Do you think it makes the country safer? Call 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll take our first caller now. We have Steve joining us in Melrose. Steve, hi.
Hi. I called in earlier today and we lost connection, I guess, and I'm afraid I might lose it here. I'm pretty much in agreeance and support of the executive orders that have been put in place. And I guess the gist of it is that it's being taken way out of proportion and sensationalized, like so many things have been in the last years, by the media. And just a real point in case here with your guest speaker, Saeed, that he's saying several cases are calling in about it. Well, we need, you know, that to me is hearsay, and that's where the news reporting needs to take responsibility.
Steve, thank you for that, for calling in. And this is a pushback that has also come from the Trump administration, saying that the media has been, in a sense, hyperventilating about this and turning the story, that it hasn't been as chaotic as it may seem to be portrayed in the media, and touching on some legal aspects as well. What do you say, Saeed?
Well, I can't speak about the media because and the reporting because, quite frankly, over the weekend I kept it to a minimum. I was too occupied by answering phone calls and communicating with lawyers who are in various airports around the country for whom, yes, it is hearsay, but it is firsthand account and experience of people who are now being subjected to the consequences of the executive order. So for them, it is not sensationalization. It is actually quite real. And similarly, whether it is via social media or other means of correspondence, having firsthand knowledge of people who are in rather dire straits. Now, again, when it comes to being in agreement of this executive order for the stated purpose, yes, if it is a matter of keeping America safe, then certainly and by all means, Muslim Americans and myself are certainly in agreement and would like to promote that goal, but only if it is going to serve the purpose at hand. And again, this line of thinking suggests as though there was an absence or some incompetence on the part of the prior administration and the U.S. government when it came to vetting. For the refugees, they require 12 different U.S. agencies who vet the process and an additional 6 international agencies to go ahead and do this. The entire process takes 18 to 24 months minimum if, in fact, those individuals are successful in passing through or running through this rather difficult gauntlet. One would suggest that by the time they come through that, they have been vetted more readily and more severely than any of the people who are trying to apply for clearance in the Trump administration.
Steve, thank you for the call. And Saeed, early on you said that the reasoning behind the move, according to the Trump administration, was to keep America safe. The Washington Post is reporting that ISIS is celebrating this executive order as a victory that could act as a recruiting tool. What is that case?
Well, clearly we find then that ISIS needs very little oxygen in order to inflame the fires that it likes to do. And here what we find is that current policies are playing right into this binary of the so-called clash of civilizations model. The fact that ISIS thrives on being able to demonstrate to alienated, disenfranchised youth, both within the Middle East and outside it, to say, see, the West, for all of its values that it likes to extol of liberty, tolerance, democracy, look at how it is treating not just one segment of its own population, but in fact Muslims, which of course is something with which the ISIS recruits will have an affinity. So here it is not a matter of ISIS having to go out and do any kind of significant promotion itself. All it has to do is direct people to the executive orders or to the president's Twitter account.
Let's take another caller now. We have Sarah joining us in Green Bay. Sarah, hi.
Hi. Part of my question and my concern is we have people, you know, saying he's doing it for our security, and I can understand that. But I have a hard time creating fear in other countries and signing an executive order without crossing, you know, your T's and dotting your I's. What happens to people with visas and green cards? And we have a president who tweets, I'm doing this because there's some bad dudes out there. We sound stupid. We sound absolutely stupid. And it's making ISIS seem smart. And we should be embarrassed. Absolutely. We need to make sure people are coming in. But I know someone who has a home in New York, and she couldn't get back. She has dogs and a job and a purpose, and she can't get back because there's bad dudes out there. At the end of the day, we have to be protective of our country, but we have to be smart. And who is advising you?
Sarah, thank you. A bunch of points there that Sarah brought up. Getting at education and information about the executive order, how it be implemented, was there time taken for coalition building, and how will it affect just sort of the flow of air travel and the way people can move freely across the country and the world. Saeed, you want to take a swing at some of those?
Sure, why not, Veronica? Well, first of all, and thank you for the question, Sarah. The main thing to see here and upon which we rely is a certain flow of process, a certain efficiency, a certain organization. And what is now emerging from these executive orders is that there was no consultation with those who are actually the professionals within Washington. Now, whether that is severe paranoia, mistrust for Washington because the president sees himself as the consummate outsider still is to be seen. But the fact that these executive orders were not vetted by anybody within the Department of State, the Department of Homeland Security, is a rather troublesome development, and particularly when it's dealing with the constitutionality of people's basic rights. That is cause for an awful lot of concern. And unfortunately, it is something which is leading to a tremendous level of mockery, not just among our adversaries like ISIS, but also amongst our allies. 2 weeks ago, I was actually on an overseas trip, which took me to Doha in Qatar, Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, and also to London, England. And the one common denominator in all three of these areas were people just mystified at what direction was happening and how America was taking this turn for something that they didn't see as very productive. Now, the other issue regarding education and those people who are here who are now being left outside the country, this is not just women and children who, again, it's very difficult to make the case that they pose a threat to national security, but also doctors at the Cleveland Clinic and at Johns Hopkins, people working for Silicon Valley, are being now excluded from returning to the country. People coming to the United States who had already received visas to enter PhD programs in places like the University of Michigan's Engineering School, they are being left out. So the fact that this is now so totalistic and is affecting so many different sectors of society and on an international level by just simply the stroke of the pen is quite remarkable.
Inside, Sarah ended with the question, who's advising him, and I'm President Trump in this case. What do you say to that? We heard news over the weekend that chief political strategist Steve Bannon had been brought on to the NSC's main committee. Maybe some of the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff taking a lesser role. What do we know about that advisory capacity right now?
It's quite telling, Veronica, about exactly who's going to be the brain trust in this White House, which not just individuals, but entire departments and institutions within the government apparatus are going to be willingly and knowingly circumvented. That should be a cause for concern of a lot of people. I mean, the government operates with certain safeguards, certain checks and balances, which are implicit within that. And it seems as though there's a very conscious effort to go ahead and move around those individuals as well as the apparatuses themselves. It seems as though, from all accounts, that Steve Bannon's fingerprints are all over these executive orders. And it seems as though this is particularly troublesome given his broader worldview when it comes to not just refugees, not just immigrants with the fear of terrorism, but immigrants to American nativism. It seems as though this is just the beginning of a longer trajectory of policy objectives, including the limitation of H-1B and other non-immigrant specialized work visas, which is, of course, going to have a major impact on Silicon Valley, the medical field, and elsewhere.
And Saeed, we're just about out of time, maybe 20 seconds left. You've got a phone ringing, but legally, what do you expect to happen next?
Well, the fortunate thing is that almost immediately we have the ACLU and other organizations who have taken the ball and run with it. We find, in fact, it was their swift work which caused now four federal judges to declare the executive order and the deportation proceedings or the exclusion proceedings to be unconstitutional. The problem, though, is that the Customs and Border Protection, there are accounts that many of them are openly defying the court order. So what we're going to find then is a battle between the executive branch and the judicial branch. So stay tuned.
Saeed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Saeed Khan from Wayne State University talking about President Trump's recent executive order banning refugees and immigrants from seven Muslim-majority countries.
After the news, we'll hear about an effort to give citizens more of a voice with their elected officials. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.